when we feel we can afford it, we'll build a modest little farm.
We'll buy a yacht and live aboard it, rolling in luxury and stylish charm.
Cows and chickens,
social whirls,
peas and cabbage,
ropes of pearls.
Soon there'll be little ones beside us. We'll have a sweet Westphalian home.
Somehow we'll grow as rich as Midas. We'll live in Paris when we're not in Rome.
Smiling babies,
marble halls,
Sunday picnics,
costume balls. What my robes of silk and satin be chic. I'll have all that I desire.
Pangloss will tutor us in Latin and Greek while we sit before the fire.
Glowing rubies,
glowing logs,
faithful servants,
faithful dogs.
We'll round the world enjoying high life, all bubbly pink champagne and gold.
We'll lead a rustic and a shy life, feeding the pigs and sweetly growing old.
Breast of peacock,
apple pie,
I love marriage.
So do I.
Happy pair, happy we, it's very rare, a we agree.
Oh, happy pair, oh, happy we, it's very rare, how we agree. Oh, happy pair, oh, happy we, it's very rare, how we agree.
Music and words that are probably very familiar to most of you, but heard from voices who will be very new to you and entirely new to you, unless you've already had a chance to see one of the great productions of musical theater in Chicago, one of the great productions of musical theater anywhere, one of the best things we've seen in the now 10-year-old new space of the Goodman Theater. And I think, and my esteemed colleague Albert Bill Williams of the Chicago Reader has said the same, the best production to date that you will have been able to see of Candide by Leonard Bernstein and various colleagues and collaborators. It has been brought fully to life by a wonderful team headed by director-adapter Mary Zimmerman and music director Doug Peck, a number of their other colleagues, and of course the overarching arc of the Goodman Theater allowing this to happen, and the Bernstein estate and office allowing all of these things to happen. You heard Jeff Packard as Candide and Lauren Molina as Cunegonda in Oh Happy We, and we'll have a chance to hear from Jeff and Lauren again in the studio singing and also talking about the show. But first, let's welcome Mary Zimmerman and Doug Peck, two mainstays of not only the Chicago theater scene, but of the idea of theater as a wonderful art form, that both a living art form and one that has both historic roots and has to be thinking of the future. So it's great to have you all here.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
Mary, how did all of this start?
You know, its origins are sort of obscure. I believe that my ex-boyfriend, Bruce Norris, introduced me to Candide when we were in college, and he's a very cynical person. He's the playwright, Chicago playwright, can be a very dark person, but he always said, oh, he would just melt whenever he talked about Candide, and I believe that he would play me the record of Garden Grow and so forth when we were falling in love. And I think that was my first acquaintance with the music. Rock Schulfer, executive producer at the Goodman, I believe thinks he originated the idea of me doing it, and that may be so, or I might have years ago said to him that Bruce had said to me, if you ever do a musical, this is a musical you should do. But without doubt, it's happening is due to Rock Schulfer. He sort of dragged me to New York. We had a meeting with the Bernstein, with his children and with his old agent in a office Kitty cornered at Carnegie Hall, and got the permission to do it. And that was about 4 years ago. And then I got very sidetracked. I was doing opera, which consumes your life. So it was sort of on the back shelf. And then I was really exhausted last September, and he was like, we must do it next year. And I even tried to withdraw around Christmas and so forth, because I was just too tired, and I felt it was a project worthy of one's full attention. At the time, I also thought, well, I am going to do a new book, but, you know, I thought, gee, I have to do it in advance. Different from any way I've ever done any show except one, I thought, it'll be all these people I've never worked with before. I, like a normal person, should write the script in advance. But when I realized I didn't really have time for that, I know this sounds odd, I sort of only had time to do it the way I normally do it, which is not to start until we start rehearsal. And I don't know if people know this or not, but pretty much everything I've ever done, I write in the wee hours of the morning between 2 or 4, 3 and 6, about like that, and I bring in pages every single day. It's shaped every single day by what happened the day before, where I feel inspired to go with it. And so when I realized I could just do that in the same old way, then that was a sort of breakthrough for me, and I felt like, no, I can do it. I can be myself, and I can do it in that method.
So. I was talking with a couple of others who've had a even longer lifetime of observing Chicago theater than I've had, but people who care very much about that Chicago aspect. And we were saying that though story theater in various terms or various emphases within that has always been a part of what you do, I think, that perhaps because of now this extensive experience that you have, going off and doing the operas and all that comes with them, that maybe even that tiredness enabled you to come to something and, quote unquote, just tell the story.
Absolutely. I mean, I know there are several instances that my three-year sojourn at the Met taught me, that put me in very good stead for this. And by the way, like, having worked at the Met, which is the epicenter of the universe of musical values and come scritto and the smartest, most polylingual human beings on the planet all congregate there to roost upon the score and to study it as a rabbinical text. Like, having gone to that extreme with musical values, I knew I was in good enough stead to do a piece of musical theater in which musical values are going to be as fantastic as we can get them, but that it is in fact an act of theater. As Doug says, theater is the noun, musical is the adjective. And so I had a certain confidence. And I also know that there are just certain things that I knew a little bit more about vocal production, and I knew, for instance, I'm positive that if I had done this show before I'd ever done these operas, I know I would have staged the overture. I know I would have. I would have felt somehow compelled to have a visual accompaniment to that thing. But working in the opera taught me the respect for the overture, and especially this overture. Mm-hmm. But I do know that other productions have had elaborate sort of pantomiming, preview sort of staging, what's the word I want, prologue sort of staging during that. And I know I would have had that same anxiety, like we must illustrate, we must show. But I love sitting in the theater for 3 minutes and 40 seconds and we just listen, and that's the time for the orchestra gets to introduce itself and to be solo in a way that it's not going to get to be, where it's always going to be knit to an image for every other minute of the evening. So here we really get to let the music take the house and introduce itself and have its moment. That's just one way in which I know that, having worked in the opera, you know, with various maestri who only have one answer when you talk to them about staging something during the overture. Like, there's only one thing that they are ever going to say, and that is...
No.
No.
Or please no. Or, you know, some version of no. You know, and I know Doug probably would have gone along with me or whatever, but I'm just glad that I sort of knew that this time around, and especially with such an iconic overture and such an entertaining one, too.
Let me insert here that the three operas that Mary has worked on, at least two, maybe all three, are now out on DVD?
They are. Mm-hmm. No, I'm sorry. Well, Armida, I have a bootleg.
Okay.
But,
call Mary if you're interested,
yes,
in the Armida.
I have it.
But Lucia
precious,
de Lammermoor and
yes.
La Sonnambula.
La Sonnambula.
I saw them in the
out.
Met
yes.
Gift shop on yes. Just last Monday, so yes. I know they're there.
They are. The Lucia's with Anna Netrebko, but this year we're doing it again with Natalie, who I originated it with, Natalie Desay. And shockingly, they're going to HD broadcast that production, which will be the first time that they've done two separate HD broadcasts of the same production, but a different cast.
Oh, very interesting.
And I'm really, really thrilled about that, because yeah. I made it with her originally,
right.
and so
right.
I'm very glad to see her return. And then I don't know if they'll release that or not.
Yeah.
Although there's certainly, she has a CD out that there's a 20-minute, the Mad Scene is on it, a bonus
right.
DVD, so
right.
you can see that.
Okay.
Yeah.
But I mention it also because we had the chance several years ago when Mary was setting off on this adventure, at least
that's
between
right.
one and two,
that's
where
right.
you came in and bared your soul of your non-opera past, and but also of your hunger and your eagerness
uh-huh,
to embrace
uh-huh.
it. And how interesting, too, to hear some of the things and to see some of the things that you learned mm-hmm. from those experiences. They're not necessarily the things that one would... It's not like you came back and said, and now I must stage this as an opera.
No. Goodness,
which,
no.
Doug Peck, maybe you and I will disagree, but I think that this was something that Leonard Bernstein often didn't get right about his own work, especially as it went on. Not about the structure, not about the pacing, not about the initial composition, but this idea that West Side Story should have opera singers, or that Candide should exist. Yes, let's have an opera form. But there was that some kind of mistrust that the greatest genius of American musical theater could think that, no, I need to succeed in the opera world instead.
With all due respect to Bernstein and Herbert von Karajan, you see that as the Maestri got older, there was that desire to really live in the musical values and slow things down and have a maximum amount of legato and let the beauty of individual sounds tell the story. I'm in a very different position in my life than those gentlemen were when they made those later recordings. For me, Candide is about wit and speed and heart and so much of the things that come from Voltaire. And it was very easy. Bernstein was a young man when he wrote the score. So to find those values in the score has been very, very easy. That question of opera or musical or both has been central to any discussion about Candide since it happened. We obviously are addressing it as theater artists because that's who we are. That's the actors we hired, the designers we hired, in some cases the musicians we hired. It's the only piece I can think of, only Cabaret maybe from musical theater and Tales of Hoffman from the opera world, come close to having as many versions. The three songs I'm just realizing that we are doing on your broadcast today have three different lyricists, which there's not a musical on this earth, if that's true, of Oh Happy We, Richard Wilbur, You Were Dead, You Know, John Latouche, and then The Candide's Lament, Stephen Sondheim. So to think that there's so many collaborators involved with this score is very exciting.
And of course, there were more.
And that's what opened the door to me. Like, I'm not going to go around rewriting books to great musicals. Mm-hmm. It's just that the door to this one has always felt sort of open. Many people have done different versions. Every iteration of Candide you see will be different. It's a kind of fluid text and a hybrid text. And I just felt, you know, that's what gave me a feeling of, like, permission that I could actually dare to, you know, do a new book, because it's an unsettled text. It has all these various versions, you know. I've been sort of very mournful the last few days at the end of our process, because I just don't know any other opportunity I will ever have. This was so unique to have the gift of this gorgeous set of songs. Mm-hmm. And in fact, too many songs, you know, you get to pick and choose a little bit because you couldn't do all of them, and some of them obviate others. They're sort of mutually exclusive almost.
Two syphilis songs, for example.
For instance. Or just
one sort of
contradictory
the
in terms
people.
Of plot points yeah. and so forth. You know, to have that array of music, and then to have a text, the Voltaire text, which is so similar in so many ways to the kinds of things I've been doing, adapting for 20 years. It's episodic, it's romantic, it's kind of goofy and funny, and yet it's really moving and sad. It's more biting and actually more modern than most texts I've done, but... I don't know that there's any other project that could feel like such a great, you know, gift, an opportunity for me. And I don't think it will ever come again. I sort of feel that. Unless maybe I was to work on something brand new. You know, that might have the same feeling for me that this did.
I think we should underline, in addition to that aspect of where this fits in, and importantly, so in Mary's career and in the set of choices she faces, we need to underline that this is not a case of something that I personally find very unfortunate, where some people looking for a Broadway revival say, here's a great musical, needs a new book. And they just decide to take the existing book, which might have been written by a Burroughs or a great book writer, and toss it and get a new book, because we have to update this, or there might have been a reference in here that's out of date now in terms of race or gender or sexuality or something. And therefore, this is a case where there's an unsettled book, as you say, mm-hmm. from the beginning, mm-hmm. Even including those 76 official mm-hmm. performances, mm-hmm. Where there even was a book writer then who came back in and out of the project right. at various times.
But so based on a masterpiece of world literature.
Right, right, right.
You know, it just is.
So that really, this is not just rewriting Bells Are Ringing. greatest show as that might
love
be.
Love Judy Holliday.
Yes, right, you know? Right.
I wrote half a dissertation on her at one point in my life.
Really?
Yes, she was my original dissertation topic. Mm-hmm.
Wow.
How her public persona was so, how her private and her public life were so sort of intertwined and intersected, and how she played upon the dumb blonde version of herself when she went before the House Committee on Un-American Activities, when she really was a red diaper baby, but she was like, I don't know nothing about politics, and they were like, oh, you poor thing. It was about that, and the sort of right. advertising.
Which does take us back to the 1950s, and to Lillian Hellman and Leonard Bernstein.
I never finished
and their
that
college.
Dissertation.
Right,
no,
but I mean, it stayed with you.
It did. I adore
her. Doug Peck, you claim to be 29 years old.
I am, indeed, yes.
How can this be? I mean, how do you know so much about music? How do you care so much about these things that happened long before you were born?
The very easy answer is it's a very Jewish value. I grew up in a Jewish home, and that desire to acquire knowledge. My grandmother took me to the opera when I was 10 years old. I saw Capriccio at the Lyric, was my very first opera.
That's not just that she took you to the opera, but she didn't take you to Bohem. She took you to Capriccio, Richard Strauss's. What happens and what comes first and all
questions
that
are important in my life today of what's more important, the words or the music, and how do words and music work together. That was kind of seminal.
Prima la musica, prima la parola. It's always the question, and the answer is they have to come together.
That's right.
You also mentioned, of course, the changing shows, Cabaret in the musical theater world, Tales of Hoffman in the opera world. I think that the other thing that you all both brought to this, intentionally or otherwise, is an understanding that mostly has been continental European, and that is that there is this world of music theater somewhere between straight Broadway musical, which is a set of contradictions in and of itself, and opera. And I'm thinking, of course, of Weill and Brecht and the Three Penny Opera, and that feeling of this is happening now in a room that you are also in theatricality, which has to have a certain rough side to it too, I think. And by that I don't mean rough wrong, but this is a glorious mass life that we're seeing. And I don't want to give away the old lady's insight, but she has an insight that sort of stops the show.
She does.
Isn't that a part of that? There has to be a kind of raw energy in this
work. Yes, I feel like there's something improvisational about that novel. There's something like, and now I'll write about this happening. And it's not a much revised novel. He wrote it really quick. Later, he introduced a scene 4 years later that I originally introduced into the show and then had to take out, much as I loved it, because he didn't bother to revise after inserting that scene, and things just sort of didn't make sense. And I felt like theatrically it had to have a sort of sense of improvisation too. In other words, the set is a sort of single unit set that has to serve for many, many things, and I knew that I didn't want to cart on wagon loads of scenery, of realistic or representational scenery, to be each of the different locations, because the novel is just so much more fleet than that. And I hope, and in most of my shows, I think I try to do this, there's images that are created metaphorically in which silently we ask the audience to shake hands with us across the footlights in order to complete that image, so that Holland is represented by a woman blowing on a little pinwheel, and a pinwheel is like a windmill, but not exactly. And that always gets like a little appreciative laugh, and they know. She says they arrived in Holland, and she blows on this little thing. And there's just many playful moments like that, which I think are in the spirit of the original novel, but also in the intensely playful spirit of the lyrics, which are really, really funny and witty and make phenomenal double and triple rhymes all the time and rhymes on the break and, you know, just really, really great. There's a playfulness in our approach. And that's absolutely true, I'm sure, of every production of Candide, but
I mean,
it's a guiding principle for
think
us.
Think of a song that is played very frequently on this station over the decades, and which is interpreted so wonderfully by Hollis Resnick, where she reviews her assimilation into different situations, and this lyric, which just sends up everything from Voltaire's own send-up to the people who wrote the show, and that's Bernstein's own lyric, right?
It is, and his wife wrote the Spanish text. It was the very first song Bernstein wrote for the show. The title page of Scottish Opera has that in his own manuscript hand, which is great to see.
I mean, that my father spoke a high middle Polish somehow gets merged into the whole thing.
Yes.
And Mary, by the way, made that work brilliantly, because in Voltaire, she's Italian, the old woman.
Right.
And Mary found a way to make the lyric of that song and the old woman's stories both be true, so we could include both of them.
She found a way that you can speak Spanish, too, to bring Felicia, Lenny, and all of the Voltaire in your work here.
But they're all
together.
Those, like, these days you have to be in the majority. I mean, there's all these little triple rhymes that are so astonishing throughout the night. Like, I don't think there's, and I know nothing, frankly, so, but based on nothing, I don't think there's wittier lyrics in the world. Yeah. I just find them
delightful. They're terrific in that they don't go too far, either.
Right.
They have that Hammerstein ability also when it's appropriate to turn themselves down and be more honest, but then bring that wit to the forefront when they have to. It's
right.
Perfection.
And
you know?
and I think, as you were alluding to earlier, Doug, that what you all have done here is not said, okay, let's write a background for a review, R-E-V-U-E, of the Bernstein songs, nor have you said that the songs will just be illustrative. You have found the way that they fit together and that, no, this argument that some have made over the years that, oh, the songs are, they just interrupt or they throw off the story. This is something that runs forward and backward, as we're going to see with Candide's Lament, where there is a work that musically and in terms of the summary of the action and of the characters' perceptions and feelings at that time anchors, in a way, the whole story.
Our actors have been very brave about trusting us on that journey of really acting these songs and not saying, okay, now the action stops and you can step forward and sing them, which these songs are good enough that you could do that,
for sure.
Which I would not say about most shows.
Right.
But they are up for making that transition with us so that, you know, Hollis Resnick is sort of the master of it in my universe of she's talking 1 second and then, oh my God, did she start singing?
And Larry too, and actually Jeff too on
All
Soon When We Feel We Can't Afford It. For me, that was the unique thing in this project that I've never had to do before, ever, and that I found like super fun, and that was how to move from speech, like how do I write the line right before the song? And to me, it's that really phenomenal moment on, you know, the plane on the runway, and when is it just like imperceptibly lifting off and is airborne into music. And there are two or three or four, it's not every time, but there's quite a few times, I think, in the production where it's like a magic trick. And the person is as fully intellectually present as if they were speaking without music, but it's song. And that as though the pitch and notes of the song are exactly what is in their head. And I find that like really, really thrilling. And that was super fun to like, the sort of like sleight of hand of what do you write right before they start singing. And actually, I've never said this, Doug, before, but he gave me a compliment very early on when we went into Oh Happy We. He just like as he was playing, he said, that's perfect, or something like that. That lead-in, that's a perfect musical theater lead-in. And I felt very proud. And from then on, secretly, I was trying to get that compliment every time. You know? I'm not sure I ever did.
Your first official musical.
For sure, or book, of course. You know, having to lead into a song in that way. I've never had anything that task before, ever.
And she nailed it, to be honest. I mean, I always knew when to bring the music in. I always knew how to make those transitions. It was just effortless.
Yeah, I wouldn't necessarily have written it in my little pages of the day. And then like, oh my gosh, he was playing. I remember that for Oh Happy We, how suddenly in Lauren's line, you started the little vamp. And but I think that's when I'd sort of heard it in my head too.
I mean, it's kind of the atmosphere I'm guessing in the daytime there at the Goodman without the open bottles of liquor, certainly without all the cigarettes. But when you see the black and white photos of the collaborators on this show in the 50s coming together, I'm not equating it, but just that sense of let's make something. Yeah. Let's see if we can come close to making it work.
But what one, it must be said, you know, we didn't write this music, The music is phenomenal. Right. And the music is what I think people are coming to, you know, initially that's what one comes to hear. And I mean, you know, that's the greatest gift. And, you know, all we're doing is like, you know.
But if you can capture that same energy when remounting a show and recreating a show, I think that isn't hubris. That's a tribute to the energy that was there when the show was made.
And I have to say that, like, there's a few lyrics in the show that I, you know, teasingly say are not as good. And I kind of feel like I know how they happened. Mm-hmm. And I don't feel bad about that. Like, I know how things are made, and I know in what desperation they're sometimes made, or in what exhaustion they're sometimes made, and so forth.
I do want to add too that when you come in, if you're coming in for the music, which many people will be, and I think you'll stay for the music as well, you may initially be a bit put off because of expectations. I think not at all because of the enactment, but that is that. We have heard the overture to Candide, so it has rightly entered the standard repertoire, not only in this country, but it's one of the few pieces of American music that's entered the repertoire outside of this country in terms of classical music. And so we are used to hearing the New York Philharmonic and Leonard Bernstein conducting, or other orchestras of similar size and heft. And here you're hearing a very fine theatrical pit orchestra play it. And I actually, though, was glad, and this is about all I want to give away about the experience of the show, I was actually glad that at first I had to do a mental and oral A-U-R-A-L double take, because once I saw, wait, we're having a theater experience here, and I had to work that through in those 3 minutes and 40 seconds of the overture, then I was ready to enter into that bargain that Mary was referring to before. And we should say, you're playing a real piano.
I am. There's nary an electronic instrument in our pit, which I'm very proud of, and I think your listeners will love. The amplification in this production is very minimal and very discreet. The dialogue is almost completely unmiked. The singing is as naturally presented as possible in a house like this with an open pit. Mm-hmm. So they are really hearing the natural voice. Mary and I happily share the exact same aesthetic with amplification, namely as little as possible. Mm-hmm. You know, you're right, Andrew, that overture has become something that it even wasn't originally. The original 1956 Broadway pit was half the size of the New York Philharmonic, and we don't even remember what that sounded like anymore. We know there's a tuba and four first trumpets and 45 strings. There's neither space nor sense for that in this production, and I'm glad we have the overture to kind of retool people's sense. We're also performing in an 800-seat theater with a cast of 19 actors. So once we got past the overture, it would be impossible and impractical to have such a large orchestra. We underscore dialogue sometimes, and it gives us a real flexibility of sort of following the singers and taking the acting journey with them.
It is an adjustment, though. Yeah, I mean, absolutely. Even for me, it was the first time I heard it. It was a big adjustment. It's 12 pieces, not 140. And
totally.
It's very exposed. You know, the overture is very exposed, and it's such a familiar piece of music. So.
There's something else that happens here, and maybe you all know this. Richard Wilbur told me a few years ago, who was the basic lyric writer, and of course went on to a very distinguished career as a poet, which had already started then, and is a great storyteller as well. That is that the overture is very much made up of threads from the songs. This is not as great as he was as the greatest overture writer of all time, Mr. Rossini, taking an overture from an opera about a kidnapped baby and making it about a redeemed woman or something.
It has not one single thing to do with the rest of the music of the symphony.
But here, it actually comes from the songs, and one of the reasons that Richard Wilbur is very happy to say that he's been able to enjoy a comfortable life is because he gets royalties for the overture.
That's right.
Even though there are no lyrics in the overture.
He does.
But because those tunes were written on lines that he had initiated.
He has a very good lawyer.
And I'm sure you probably all had to deal with things like that. But at the same time, it's important to know, as a part of that theatricality of the work, that these threads are always weaving and interweaving, and that things refer back to the overture, and the overture does take us in to the show. So we urge you in the strongest possible terms to get tickets to see Voltaire and Bernstein's Candide at the Goodman Theater as envisioned and recreated by Mary Zimmerman, Doug Peck, and their many wonderful and gifted colleagues that feature the voices and the bodies and acting of Jeff Packard and Lauren Molina. Everyone in the cast is just super. I'm just going to mention three veterans of the Chicago and other stages, Larry Yando, Tom Olino, and Hollis Resnick, but the names that will be less familiar to you, you'll recognize the faces and you'll want to see and hear the other people. This really is the finest Candide that has been created that I've seen, of the many that I've seen, and one of the finest that's ever been created that I've heard. And it's a real privilege to be able to go over right downtown to the Goodman through Halloween, through October 31st, to see this extended run of this marvelous production. And then you go to Washington, D.C., yes. Right?
Yes, to the Shakespeare Theater in D.C., yes. Yeah,
nay, the Folger.
Yes, not right, the Folger.
No longer, but yeah, no, born right. As the Folger Theater, right?
Yes.
Yeah,
but originally they were there, but they actually haven't been in the Folger Library right. For a long time.
It's the brand new Shakespeare Theater, mm-hmm. And you'll have a chance to see it there if you miss it. Here in Chicago, but miss it at your peril. Doug Peck, Mary Zimmerman, thanks so
thank
much.
You so thank you, much. Andrew. Thank you.
Is this all then, this the world? Death and envy, fear and blindness. What is kindness but a lie? What to live for but to die? I will never miss the world, never this one which is hateful. Let me die then, only grateful. Dying sooner was spared this world. What is kindness but a lie? And what to live for but to
Candide's Lament, Jeff Packard, Candide, from the show of the same name. You Were Dead, You Know. We heard Jeff Packard and Lauren Molina as Candide and Cunegonde in this excerpt from Candide. Among other things that you all were able to do with this show is to go through, as we've talked about, and we'll talk about more, all the pieces written at different times mm-hmm. for this work. And one section in particular that's going to sound both familiar and unfamiliar, I think, to many people in the audience, is this solo that in this structure appears towards the end of Act One, or in the mm-hmm. latter part of Act One. And that is Candide alone on the stage, Candide's Lament. Tell us where this came from, why we have and haven't heard it before.
Right. Candide's Lament was written by Bernstein for the original production, and the director, Tyrone Guthrie, and his collaborators cut it. They felt it was boring. They felt it slowed down the action. However, that theme, da-da-dee-da, is the central musical motif of Candide. It's in the overture. It's in the Paris Waltz. It's in You Are Dead, You Know. It's in Oh Happy We. It's in Make Our Garden Grow. It's everywhere. It's in the Act One finale. And that's Candide's solo utterance of it. It was put back in later productions. What's hard about it, in the structure of Voltaire, Candide never finds Cunegonde's dead body laying on a battlefield. So the original lyric, which we are not performing, Cunegonde, Is It True?, does not fit with the structure we're using. That's a problem that's been encountered before, and Sondheim wrote a new lyric for the 73 Chelsea version called This World, and that's the lyric that Jeff sings. Mary and I went back and forth about the inclusion of that song. It happens in our production right after the auto da fe. Candide is left alone on stage. And I think it's not sharing too much backstory that Mary wrote a speech for that moment. And the way she works, we come in and read the new pages for that day every day. And I quietly on the side said, what if Jeff sang the song after the speech? And Mary said, fine, we can try it. That sounds great. So Jeff did a speech, and then we did a song. And that's the structure we went with for a while. And the great thing about working in a theater like the Goodman, when you have a five-week process, we tried speech only. We tried song only. We tried speech and song. And the moment that felt really right, the structure that felt really right, was coming out of the auto da fe, which is a big, almost operatic musical sequence, and keeping the music going into Jeff singing that song is sort of the final product we wound up with.
And I would like to say, since I play Candide, and
do you now?
Yes, I do.
In my actory brain.
I felt it very important that he has that song to sing, because I feel like in many ways this production explores sort of the darker, more painful aspects of what this man goes through. And I feel like that, you know, as it is found frequently throughout, that motif is found mm-hmm. frequently throughout other music, it really represents for me and my Candide he at his most painful time. I mean, he was just whipped. He'd lost his love, and he just saw his hero killed. You know, it represents, and every time I hear that in subsequent songs, it brings me back to that darkness, that pain. And I feel like without that, it's a little bit less realized. At least my Candide would be.
That's it's wonderful, and I think one of the things we try to remind people of with this program is that actory brains do work like other brains, and you all often have a great deal to say, and very insightfully as well. This is something that in works of music that Bernstein was tremendously familiar with, mm-hmm. though he himself wrote fewer of them, but really well thought out, complex, single works of music mm-hmm. where there is what a composer at various times, we'll use the 20th century term, has created a cell. Mm-hmm. And that cell might be in the middle of the piece, it might be at the beginning, it might be the end, it might just be on his or her composition table. I mean, Doug knows this stuff very well. It's what we all live and breathe in composition and classical music analysis. By putting the cell back in, dramatically, theatrically, mm-hmm. and musically, I think there's a connection, there's threads, there are ropes, mm-hmm. and that make the show connect. And I have to say, there were fewer moments than there might have been where I was really sort of in tears during the performance, not because I wasn't moved, but because I was worried that if I lost it, I'd miss something. Mm-hmm. But that was a moment where I just said, what if Bernstein could see this and hear this? This, you know, this was all the dreams actually happening here. And that's just something that it's clear that each of you coming from these different backgrounds recognize, and even something that brief makes possible and informs what you all are doing the rest of the time.
I'm glad to hear you talk about Bernstein that way, because you have to really honestly go to Haydn, Mozart, Stravinsky to find people that understand theme and variations as well as he does, and how to transform a theme. And this is a dramatic work as well, so a musical theme and variation has great emotional payoffs, but in a drama, in an opera, they have intellectual payoff as well. Mm-hmm. They pay off on every level. So when Jeff sings that exact same melody to the old woman in Cunegonda at the start of the Act One finale, he's acting like Candide acts and taking something sorrowful and making it positive. Mm-hmm. And you can mm-hmm. feel that in the way. Of great help to me was Bernstein's quote-unquote Scottish opera version. He made very clear at the end of his life and his career, with both that published score and that recording, what his architecture was, what his structure, what his order was. Obviously, we've made some moves from that to satisfy Voltaire and put things in that order, but musically, an understanding of that is throughout this production, for sure. Mm-hmm.
I would love to know from Lauren Molina and Jeff Packard what their prior exposure to or experience of Candide, if any, might have been. I'm really just curious. I don't know the answer.
Well, I grew up in a classical music household, so The Overture was always very iconic for me. I grew up listening to that. And then when I got more into musical theater in my high school and college experience, I learned some more of the music, and I just fell in love with the score. So that's pretty much my experience with it.
I did a production of Candide in college. I went to the University of Cincinnati Conservatory of Music, I think my sophomore year, and I was one of a soldier or, you know, any number of, you know, people in the show. So I knew the show musically through that, and it's been, you know, on my iPod, a bunch of different versions. I sort of love musical theater, so I was familiar with the score through that.
I find it interesting that in a way, you give us kind of two halves of an answer for people of your generation, and that is, one, the work has such a place in history in this kind of one leg in classical and one leg in musical theater, and so that, Lauren, makes sense you might have gotten that from your folks, and then because of your own training and interests connected to other parts of it, and just as it might make sense that somebody would have, as Jeff did, encountered the show in school and then have it on his iPod, you know?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. 'Cause I'd have to explain what an iPod was to a lot of the people who knew the show from the 50s on. But that's, of course, also what makes it a living show and not an artifact, right, Doug Peck?
Absolutely. That sense of hybrid and living in two worlds was one of the great things to get to figure out about this piece, is how to address it as theater artists while still preserving all of the musical values, homing all of the different scores that Bernstein put together over the years, and servicing them with singing actors like we are in this production.
Lauren and Jeff, how did you all come to this production? You're not Chicago. Well, now you are Chicago actors, and you can never shake it off.
Who would want to?
I love Chicago actors.
I mean, we don't want to bill you all as the Rock of Ages twins, right?
No.
I mean, we don't even want to mention that, right?
No.
So what was it that brought you here? A brilliant casting director, or the word Candide flashing on a sign somewhere?
Well, you know, it's sort of strange to say this with Mary in the room. I had heard about the production at the Goodman, and I had seen Mary's work in the past. I saw a production of Arabian Nights at the Kansas City Rep when I was working there, and I was sort of fascinated by that brand of storytelling and the episodic nature of it. And so when I heard that she was doing Candide at the Goodman, I thought, I would really like to see that. I think that's a really good fit. And I was excited about the making of that Candide. I also knew I was sort of right for the role of Candide, but it is my wildest dream to have been a part of watching that creation. So it's all sort of worked out well for me, I guess.
Playing Cunegonda is an absolute dream role, to sing this music and to create a character who goes from one spectrum to the other side completely, and to take that journey as a character is really exciting. So my journey with the production, I went to the audition, you know, my agents got me the appointment, and
but you had an interest initially.
Oh my gosh, yeah. Yes, yeah. absolutely. When I heard they were doing it, before I even could ask my agents, they're like, you have an appointment. And so I was really excited, and I had never sung Glitter and Be Gay before, but I know the music very well, so I had to learn it in 4 days on a 5-show weekend with a gig, and I actually ended up losing my voice before the audition, and I was like, I can't let this get away from me. So I did what I had to do to be able to sing it, and fortunately everyone kind of believed in me, and I had a callback, and I put myself on tape, and I got the part, and I could not be more thrilled that I am a part of this stunning production.
I think it would be interesting for people to visualize, we were in the same production on Broadway of Rock of Ages, which is an 80s metal, you know, musical. And, you know, many times in New York, everybody's talking about the auditions that they have. But the fact that it worked out that we were playing opposite each other, if you look back, you know, 5 months ago, and you would see me in a black 80s wig with black lipstick talking to Lauren in some other strange 80s outfit about the music of Candide and hoping that we would get this backstage when there's this, you know, raucous rock and roll music happening. So it's sort of bizarre that it's worked out that we were here together. But hopefully all for the best.
I mean, it does almost make one believe in the absurd teachings of Dr. Pangloss, because one of the things that makes this production such a triumph is the perfect casting, much of that in the other roles being from people who are known to Chicago audiences, known to the Goodman, known to Mary, known to Doug. But if one had to, and I will be happy to embarrass you on the radio here by saying this, but if one had to create a Candide and a Cunegonde right now for 2010, without knowing them and without saying, gosh, I wish we had so-and-so, because you wouldn't know so-and-so yet, really, because you don't want someone who's not the right age. And the so-and-sos are here. I mean, you guys are Candide and Cunegonde. And I was just, I make it a point not to know as much as possible, not to know what's going to be in a show, so that I know as little as possible, especially if it's a show where I have a lot of opinions before I come into it, as I think we all probably do about Candide. And I just said, I'm putting my trust in this thing. And then when each of you is unveiled in the show, and they're dressed, don't worry. I just meant when your characters appear. Well, there are moments, but you can bring the kids if you want to see disembowelment, if you want to see a slow motion bayoneting, it's okay. The kids know this already. But you all really are there. And the fact that it's a first in the role for each of you and a first in the show for one of you, I think that we you need that naivete. And I don't mean that in a bad, I mean naivete, you know, naivete, as the show discusses philosophically, among other things, can be a good thing. It doesn't mean you're ignorant.
Yeah.
Right. I think especially with the process of creating this new Candide, this very new Candide, I think it was sort of important that we had little experience with it in the past, I think. You know, because we created it day to day with Mary and her process, we were sort of forced to trust and believe everything. And I think that's where the truth and the honesty, at least for my Candide, hopefully comes from. And I don't know if that would be the case if we had a big past with playing the role before, or you know, certain ideas of how it should be or how it shouldn't be.
Absolutely.
It's hard to be Candide and Cunegonde in Dr. Pangloss's classroom if you're not Candide and Cunegonde in Dr. Pangloss's classroom.
Yeah. Right?
Yeah.
Oh, no, I mean, first of all, thank you for your really nice words before.
Well, thanks for your work.
But I was just going to say that, you know, in approaching this, when I first had the audition, I was listening to a lot of the older recordings of it. And then once I had the music in my body, I never listened to it again. And I had seen one production of Candide at Lincoln Center, you know, with Kristen Chenoweth being Kristen Chenoweth, and, you know, Patty, and I loved it. I had so much fun watching it, but it was very cartoony and very broad. And in Mary's vision, you know, she wanted to make it more real and honest. And I had to put all of the preconceived notions of what Cunegonde was behind me and very much start with a clean slate and say, who is this person? What is her journey? Each day we're getting new pages of script. How are these layers forming, and where is she going? And I think that this production is really special because you can believe these characters' journey so close to the novel, and Mary should definitely be commended for her work in that.
There's no reason that there needs to be a single version of a show. The fact that this is, as far as I have been able to see and hear, and my most knowledgeable colleague on Matters Musical Theater, Albert Williams, Bill Williams of The Reader, you know, this is the best Candide those of us who know and love this show have seen. That doesn't, though, mean there aren't other ways of doing it, or
Absolutely.
That there shouldn't
Absolutely.
Be other ways of doing it. But for a way of doing it where these goals of freshness, of bringing Voltaire's book alive and bringing Bernstein and his collaborators' music and lyrics alive, you have succeeded in not re-performing other people's parts. Now, I'm old, but not that old. I never saw Richard Rounsville on stage in 1956. but I mean, to say that there are aspects and touches of his presentation vocally of Candide, that's not to insult Jeff at all, but there certainly isn't a sense of, okay, now we're going to have a little Barbara Cook, now we're going to have a little Jerry Hadley. These are wonderful artists, of course, and their contributions are indelible. But you have to, in theater, make your own contribution, right? Otherwise, it's an impersonation show.
Absolutely. I'm so glad to hear you say that about the book and the score, because my involvement with Mary since the very first day we were hired to work on this together, there's a central thing that's been repeated for 60 years, that the book and the score of Candide don't match. And we sort of have said that before we even thought about that as people who like the music theater. And I think Bernstein deserves a lot more credit than that. He was a Voltaire scholar, a Rousseau scholar, a very, very, very brilliant man who knew exactly what he was doing by writing these songs for this book. And we found time and time again working with these terrific singing actors and with Mary's new words that the music of Bernstein infuses and interprets Voltaire in a fantastic way.
Absolutely.
You don't want to have the feeling when you get to Make Our Garden Grow that something that hasn't happened yet is happening. You want to get the sense that it's a culmination of something. We've tried to really keep Bernstein's musical architecture alive in this production. Obviously, as you said, there's been so many changes over the years to fit different books and different interpretations of Voltaire. But Bernstein obviously thematically knew exactly what he was doing. And be it tiny little things like putting the ship music the first time we go on a boat so that you've heard that by the time you get to the Act One finale. An audience member may not notice that. But that's the work we're trying to do, to bring back some of his architecture, to use as much music as possible throughout the Voltaire. We have probably more underscoring in this production than has ever been in a production of Candide, to keep that sense of the musical alive throughout.
Well, I really want to thank both for their performances in Candide at the Goodman and for their coming in and performing semi-live for us. That is, they were alive when they performed it, and we hope they'll still be alive when you hear the broadcast, but they're not in the studio at 10 o'clock at night on a Monday night. That's their night off. Oh, they might be singing somewhere. In fact, I think they will be singing in some places. There'll be some performances over the course of the run at Pettorino's in the same building as the Goodman. But I want to thank Jeff G-E-O-F-F Packard and Lauren Molina so much for their performances, their being Candide and Cunegonde, and also their being here with us. And not only, of course, should you see and hear them now, but keep your eyes and ears open for their names and their performances in the future. These are wonderful young performers who I hope are just going to continue to go from success to success. Thanks so much.
Thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
Is it true?
Is it you?
Cunegonde.
Candide.
Cunegonde.
Candide.
Cunegonde. This be so. You were dead, you know. You were shot and bayoneted too.
That is very true. Oh, but love will find a way.
Then what did you do?
We'll go into that another day. Now let's talk of you. You are looking very well. Weren't you clever, dare to survive?
I have a sorry tale to tell. I escaped more dead than alive.
Oh, where did you go?
Oh, I wandered to and fro.
Oh, what torture, oh, what pain.
All in Portugal and Spain.
Oh, what torture.
All in Portia.
Oh, what torture.
I would do it all again to find you at last, united after so much pain.
But the pain is past.
We are one again.
We are one at last.
One again.
One at last.
One again.
One at last.
One.
Dead You Know. We heard Jeff Packard and Lauren Molina as Candide and Cunegonda in this excerpt from Candide. We'd like to thank Doug Peck, Mary Zimmerman, Jeff Packard, and Lauren Molina for coming in and sharing products of their minds and lungs with us today. We'd like to thank our old pal Eric Arunas for doing sound and music engineering. Great to be working with Eric again. We'd like to thank, as always, Matt DeStefano for making the whole production sound great. And we'd like to thank Beth Roberts for her additional assistance on this production. And we'd like to thank Carly Levitin and Denise Schneider for helping to make this program all come together. And of course, Doug Peck, musical director of Candide, was at the Steinway live accompanying our Candide and Cunegonda on all of those excerpts. We'd like to thank our funders, Alphawood Foundation, Susan and Dick Kiphart, and other friends of this program. Let us know what you thought about this or any of our other programs. Drop us a line at RENTAP, that's Patner spelled backwards, RENTAP at AOL.com. And you can catch this program again or any of our programs online through our absolutely free Critical Thinking podcast, WFMT.com/Critical Thinking. I'm Andrew Patner. We'll see you next week.